like gallopy, and it's like obviously a drum machine, and it's really, really weird and very distinct though. Before that was some Drudk with Sunwheel off of Autumn Aurora, one of probably contender for one of my favorite black metal songs ever. Just so soft and so epic. Just don't know how they achieve that sort of blend of, you know, they blend the keyboards and the, you know, the guitar riffs and everything so perfectly. It just sounds so soft. I love it. Before that, Deathspell Omega, Succubus of All Vices. This was my unintentional Northern Heritage block, so I did Deathspell, Warlog, and Diaboli all in the same block. The Deathspell was off of the CD of Inquisitors of Satan. Before that was the Three-Angled Void album from Warlog from the other year, and then before that was Awakening of Nordic Storm from Diaboli. Alright, that will close out the show. Thanks all for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Give you sounds.
I will later if you take me trick or treating.
Come on, let's go.
And so Josh and Edward and Aaron and Teeny and Jack Lantern went off trick or treating.
Who goes first?
We all go together. You shouldn't go trick or treating alone.
Okay.
Trick or treat.
Come on in.
I'm sorry, we're not supposed to go into houses of strangers.
You're right. I'll go get you a treat. Now, you just wait right there, and I'll be right back.
Make another scary sound, Mr. O'Lantern.
How about the wickedest witch in the world?
What was that scary sound?
The wickedest witch in the world.
Oh. Okay, here's your treats.
Thank you. Come on, let's go to the next house.
Hey, wait for me!
And me!
And they all had a wonderful time trick-or-treating all around the neighborhood, being careful to look both ways before they crossed the street. And when they got home with all their treats, they sat down in a circle around Jack-O-Lantern, who said,
"Would you like to hear a scary Halloween story?"
Yes.
This is the story of a haunted house. In it lived a ghost, a skeleton, and a bat. Last Halloween, when they were getting ready to go out to scare everyone, they went into the closet to put on their scariest costumes, when suddenly the wind blew through the spider webs covering the windows, and the door slammed shut, locking them in the closet, where they have lived for a whole year, waiting for you to come into the haunted house to let them out. You come through the front door, 7 steps away from that closet. You take the first step. It's dark and quiet. You take the second step. The third step. You know what's behind that closet door. You take the fourth step. You take the fifth step. You take the sixth step. You're 1 step away from the ghost, the skeleton, and the bat. You take the seventh step. Don't be scared. Open the doors.
Hello.
It sure was a good story, Mr. O'Lantern.
How did you learn to tell scary stories?
Well, one day I had a donut, and suddenly my mouth could talk.
A donut?
That's right. Winchell's donuts do magic things to your mouth.
A Winchell's donut really, really does it. Donut!
And now, for all you girls and boys at home, I have some scary sounds for you.
Of the realms of snow. It's at her lulled, the pole arisen wind, or once its broad and breathless petals pined in gardens of Persepolis, aglow with fiery sordid sunlight, and the slow red waves of sand, invincible and blind. On Orient Isles, or Isles Hesperian, through mystic days ere mortal time began, it flowered above the ever-flowering foam. Or, legendless in lands of yesteryear, it flamed among the violets. Near, how near, to unenchanted fields and hills of home. Ladies and gentlemen, the hour has rolled around at last, and it is now time for the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on radio. Yes, dear fiends, this is the Ask Dr. Howell Show, and it is I, Dr. Howland Owl, you now hear, your irritating horror host, for a program of recondite pleasures and strange, new, challenging concepts, newly arisen, though perhaps unearthed from some fabled, lost and obscured antiquity, smothered by the sands of time. We shall bring forth these prodigies and wonders for you, our listening audience, fans of the show, etherettes and rocket rookies. I cherish your correspondence and communication here. So often there are technical problems created by gremlins without understanding of what should comprise the nature of a podcast, which pretends to be a broadcast. And tonight, we are going to provide a special voice from the southwestern desert, the great Sonoran desert of southern Arizona, a little bit of southwestern New Mexico, a bit of southeastern California and northern Mexico. There live the amazing creatures whose... whose acquaintance I have been fortunate in past times to make. And if one in particular we shall hear, often despised and maligned as a killer of men and animals, which it may be if molested by them or you. But in this case, we expect to sound a note of charity across the lines of species and the bonds of consanguinity. Yes, we shall hear more anon. As far as it is possible to ascertain, we expect to entertain no guests this evening, unless K-Rob is charitable enough to enter and provide us with some company and another voice. Now prepare for this different scale of values and begin. With banners flying and uplifted, with our guerdon shining bright across gulfs of ignorance and unknowing, this is indeed the beginning of one show which is a piece of a huge interwoven tapestry of multiple shows that the listeners know better than anyone else. Seed, a powerful hallucinogen, as Aunt Bertha knew.
Who has the hallucinogen?
The mustard seed of faith that Aunt Bertha offers.
Yes, the mustard seed of faith. Yes, that's right.
Billy and Timmy.
Yes, you've got to catch up with these things if you want to experience the mustard seed of faith. Let us not loaf when we do sandwich these concepts into our presentation. After all, like the there are many internal layers, each one underlying the other, and we relish the opportunity to bring you these special notes.
Cake. Damn, this is good. Who is it?
Cake.
Cake. Whoever you say it, I like it.
I want a girl with a mind like a diamond.
Nice.
I want a girl who knows what's best.
I like your voice.
A girl with shoes
like a
and
a
eyes.
There's a girl with cake who lives on my street.
All right. And you want cake?
Her name's King O. She's Japanese. It's really nice.
She's playing with her jewelry. She's putting up her hair. She's touring the facility.
When COVID started, she came by and said, I can go to the grocery store and buy things for you.
I'll get COVID for you. Oh.
Yeah, was that it?
No.
You guys, oh, dang.
That was a nice offer. And then last year, as I was backing for Burning Man, she came by. But usually, I go by her house and I don't even see it. But once, years ago, I was coming back from having done the Puzzling Evidence show, and she was out on the street wrapped in her bathrobe with her little dog, which she brought out to.
That little dog's name is Kate.
Well, no, that's her name, but she was quite effective in this flimsy bathrobe. We had a nice conversation.
Something deep inside.
That's all. I mean, I don't want to listen to it.
You know,
it's good. My daughter would like to get her ready and not change her idea.
It's very engaging. I really enjoy this stuff a lot.
I don't like the non-
nice show that brought to you by
us. I think that's the best.
Did somebody keep the bucket?
I've got a super girl that some feminist would have.
Does you mean the bucket?
Hey, this is clean though.
Ahem, Supergirl is un-American. Yes, he's a Kryptonian.
Now I call
him surgeon disappointed because he is assigned to scrub the latrines? Is the preteen worried because she has been assigned to drive the tractor? Just remember, it's not your place to interfere with their free will choice to surrender their free will. Your place, as cult members, is to get the job done. However, there is no reason why you should not make your workplace as pleasant for you as possible. Learn these mint ways to make complaints depart. For example, time control. These layabouts and whiners will go on and on about how things take too much time, as if they had something better to do. What is more likely is they don't even know how little time it takes to get most things done. For the steadfastly recalcitrant, a strict bread and water diet is in order. For those who may still be swayed by reason and evidence, however puzzling, ask them to determine how much time a task requires. Yes, the time ticks away, like drops of blood, like grains of sand, or like grains of wheat stolen by individual locusts from the silo of the king or pharaoh. And yet, by this gradual accretion, such a great change may occur as to produce a vacuity where there was once abundance. Can this process be reversed? We shall now see. We began tonight's show with a poem by Clark Ashton Smith, but now we will proceed to our prime feature of the evening. The life and death of a Western gladiator. Was born on a summer morning in the shady mouth of a cave. Three others were born with him, another male and two females. He each was about 5 inches long and slimmer than a lead pencil. Their mother left them a few hours after they were born. A day after that, his brother and sisters left him also. He was all alone. Nobody cared whether he lived or died. His tiny brain was very dull. He had no arms or legs. His skin was delicate. Nearly everything that walked on the ground or burrowed in it, that flew in the air or swam in the water or climbed trees, was his enemy. But he didn't know that. He knew nothing at all. He was aware of his own existence, and that was the sum of his knowledge. The direct rays of the sun could, in a short time, kill him. If the temperature dropped too low, he would freeze. Without food, he would starve. Without moisture, he would die of dehydration. If a man or a horse stepped on him, he would be crushed. If anything chased him, he could run neither very far nor very fast. Thus it was at the hour of his birth. Thus it would be, with modifications, all his life. But against these drawbacks, he had certain qualifications that fitted him to be a competitive creature of this world and equipped him for its warfare. He could exist a long time without food or water. His very smallness at birth protected him when he most needed protection. Instinct provided him with what he lacked in experience. In order to eat, he first had to kill, and he was eminently adapted for killing. In sacs in his jaws, he secreted a virulent poison. To inject that poison, he had two fangs, hollow and pointed. Without that poison and those fangs, he would have been among the most helpless creatures on earth. With them, he was among the deadliest. He was, of course, a baby rattlesnake. A desert diamondback named Crotalus atrox by the herpetologists Baird and Girard, and so listed in the Catalogue of North American Reptiles in its issue of 1853. He was grayish brown in color, with a series of large, dark, diamond-shaped blotches on his back. His tail was white, with five black crossbands. It had a button on the end of it. Little Crotalus lay in the dust in the mouth of his cave. Some of his kinfolk lay there, too. It was their home. That particular tribe of rattlers had lived there for scores of years. The cave had never been seen by a white man. Sometimes as many as 200 rattlers occupied the den. Sometimes the numbers shrunk to as few as 40 or 50. The tribe members did nothing at all for each other except breed. They hunted singly. They never shared their food. They derived some automatic degree of safety from their numbers, but their actions were never concerted toward using their numbers to any end. If an enemy attacked one of them, the others did nothing about it. Young Crotalus's brother was the first of the litter to go out into the world, and the first to die. He achieved a distance of 50 feet from the den when a Sonoran racer, 4 feet long and hungry, came upon him. The little rattler, despite his poison fangs, was a tidbit. The racer, long skilled in such arts, snatched him up by the head and swallowed him down. Powerful digestive juices in the racer's stomach did the rest. Then the racer, appetite whetted, prowled around until it found one of Crotalus's little sisters. She went the way of the brother. Nemesis of the second sister was a chaparral cock. This cuckoo, or road runner, as it is called, found the baby amid some rocks, uttered a cry of delight, scissored it by the neck, shook it until it was almost lifeless, banged and pounded it upon a rock until life had indeed left it, and then gulped it down. Crotalus, somnolent in a cranny of the cave's mouth, neither knew nor cared. Even if he had, there was nothing he could have done about it. On the fourth day of his life, he decided to go out into the world himself. He rippled forth uncertainly, the transverse plates on his belly serving him as legs. He could see things well enough within his limited range, but a 5-inch-long snake can command no great field of vision. He had an excellent sense of smell, but having no ears, he was stone deaf. On the other hand, he had a pit, a deep pockmark between eye and nostril. Unique, this organ was sensitive to animal heat. In pitch blackness, Crotalus, by means of the heat messages recorded in this pit, could tell whether another animal was near and could judge its size. That was better than an ear. The single button on his tail could not, of course, yet rattle. Crotalus wouldn't be able to rattle until that button had grown into 3 segments. Then he would be able to buzz. He had a wonderful tongue. It looked like an exposed nerve and was probably exactly that. It was forked, and Crotalus thrust it in and out as he traveled. It told him things that neither his eyes nor his nose nor his pit told him. Snake fashion, Crotalus went forth, not knowing where he was going, for he had never been anywhere before. Hunger was probably his prime mover. In order to satisfy that hunger, he had to find something smaller than himself and kill it. He came upon a baby lizard sitting in the sand. Eyes, nose, pit, and tongue told Crotalus it was there. Instinct told him what it was and what to do. Crotalus gave a tiny 1-inch strike and bit the lizard. His poison killed it. He took it by the head and swallowed it. This was his first meal. During his first 2 years, Crotalus grew rapidly. He attained a length of 2 feet. His tail had 5 rattles on it, and its button. He rarely bothered with lizards anymore, preferring baby rabbits, chipmunks, and round-tailed ground squirrels. Because of his slow locomotion, he could not run down these agile little things. He had to contrive instead to be where they were when they would pass. Then he struck swiftly, injected his poison, and ate them after he died. At 2, he was formidable. He had grown past the stage where a racer or a roadrunner could safely tackle him. He had grown to the size where other desert dwellers, coyotes, foxes, coatis, wildcats, knew it was better to leave him alone. And at 2, Crotalus became a father, his life being regulated by circles. His cycles were plant-like. The peach tree does not know when it is time to flower, but flower it does because its cycle orders it to do so. In the same way, Crotalus did not know when it was time for young desert diamondback rattlers to pair off and breed, but his cycle knew. he found her on a rainy morning. Kroglis's courtship was at first sinuous and subtle, slow and stealthy. Then, suddenly, it became dynamic. A period of exhaustion followed. Two metabolic machines had united to produce new metabolic machines. Of that physical union, six new rattlesnakes were born. Thus, Kroglis at two had carried out his major primary function. He had reproduced his kind. In 2 years, he had experienced everything that was reasonably possible for desert diamondback rattlesnakes to experience. Everything except death. He had not experienced death for the simple reason that there had never been an opportunity for anything bigger and stronger than himself to kill him. Now, at two, because he was so formidable, that opportunity became more and more unlikely. He grew more slowly in the years following his initial spurt. At the age of 12, he was 5 feet long. Few of the other rattlers in his den were older or larger than he. He had a castanet of 14 segments. It had been broken off occasionally in the past, but with each new molting, a new segment appeared. His first skin shedding back in his babyhood had been a bewildering experience. He did not know what was happening. His eyes clouded over until he could not see. His skin thickened and dried until it cracked in places. His pit and his nostrils ceased to function. There was only one thing to do, and that was to get out of that skin. Crotalus managed it by nosing against the bark of a shrub until he forced the old skin down over his head, bunching it like a rolled stocking around his neck. Then he pushed around rocks and sticks and branches, literally crawling out of the skin by slow degrees. Wriggling free at last, he looked like a brand new snake. His skin was bright and shiny, satiny. His eyes and nostrils were clear. His pit sang with sensation. For the rest of his life, he was to molt 3 or 4 times a year. Each time he did it, he felt as if he had been born again. At 12, he was a magnificent reptile. Not a single scar defaced his rippling symmetry. He was diabolically beautiful and deadly poisonous. His venom was his only weapon, for he had no power of constriction. Yellowish in color, his poison was odorless and tasteless. It was a highly complex mixture of proteids, each in itself direly toxic. His venom worked on the blood. The more poison he injected with a bite, the more dangerous the wound. The pain rendered by his bite was instantaneous, and the shock accompanying it was profound. Swelling began immediately, to be followed by a ghastly oozing. Injected directly into a large vein, his poison brought death quickly, for the victim died when it reached his heart. At the age of 20, Crotalus was the oldest and largest rattler in his den. He was 6 feet long and weighed 13 pounds. His whole world was only about a mile in radius. He had fixed places where he avoided the sun when it was hot and when he was away from his cave. He knew his hunting grounds thoroughly, every game trail, every animal burrow. He was a fine old machine, perfectly adapted to his surroundings, accustomed to a life of leisure and comfort. He dominated his little world. the mighty seasonal rhythms of the desert were as vast pulsations, and the lives of the rattlesnakes were attuned to them. Spring sun beat down, spring rains fell, and as the plants of the desert ended their winter hibernations, so did the vipers in their lair. The plants opened forth and budded, the den opened too, and the snakes crawled forth. The plants fertilized each other, and new plants were born. The snakes bred, and new snakes were produced. The desert was repopulated. In the autumn, the plants began to close. In the same fashion, the snake den began to close. The reptiles returned to it, lay like lingering blossoms about the entrance for a while, then disappeared within it when winter came. There they slept until summoned forth by a new spring. Crotalus was 20 years old. He was in the golden age of his viperhood. But men were approaching. Spilling out of their cities, men were settling in that part of the desert where Crotalus lived. They built roads and houses, set up fences, dug for water, planted crops. They homesteaded the land. They brought alien animals with them. Cows, horses, dogs, cats, barnyard fowl. The roads they built were death traps for the desert dwellers. Every morning, new dead bodies lay on the roads. The bodies of the things the men had run over and crushed in their vehicles. That summer, Crotalus met his first dog. It was a German shepherd, which had been reared on a farm in the Midwest, and there had gained the reputation of being a snake killer. Black snakes, garter snakes, pilots, water snakes, it delighted in killing them all. It would seize them by the middle, heedless of their tiny teeth, and shake them violently until they died. This dog met Crotalus face to face in the desert at dusk. Crotalus had seen coyotes aplenty and feared them not. Neither did the dog fear Crotalus, although Crotalus was 6 feet long then, as thick in the middle as a motorcycle tire, and had a head the size of a man's clenched fist. Also, this snake buzzed and buzzed and buzzed. The dog was brave, and a snake was a snake. The German shepherd snarled and attacked. Crotalus struck him in the underjaw. His fangs sank in almost half an inch and squirted big blobs of hemotoxic poison into the tissues of the dog's flesh. The shepherd bellowed with pain, backed off, groveled with his jaws in the desert sand, and attacked again. He seized Crotalus somewhere by the middle of his body and tried to flip him in the air and shake him, as in the past he had shaken slender black snakes to their death. In return, he received another poison blurting stab in his flank, and a third in the belly, and a fourth in the eye, as the terrible writhing snake bit wherever it would sink its fangs. The German shepherd had had enough. He dropped the big snake, and in sick, agonizing bewilderment, crawled somehow back to his master's homestead and died. Homemaker looked at his dead dog and became alarmed. If there was a snake around big enough to kill a dog that size, it could also kill a child, and probably a man. It was something that had to be eliminated. The homesteader told his fellow farmers, and they agreed to initiate a war of extermination against the snakes. The campaign during the summer was sporadic. The snakes were scattered over the desert, and it was only by chance that the men came upon them. Even so, at summer's end, 26 of the vipers had been killed. When autumn came, the men decided to look for the rattler's den and execute mass slaughter. The homesteaders had become desert wise and knew what to look for. They found Crotalus's lair without too much trouble. A rock outcropping on a slope that faced the south. Cast-off skins were in evidence in the bushes. Bees flew idly in and out of the den's mouth. Convenient benches and shelves of rock were at hand, where the snakes might lie for a final sunning in the autumn air. They killed the three rattlers they found at the den when they first discovered it. They made plans to return in a few more days when more of the snakes had congregated. They decided to bring along dynamite with them and blow up the mouth of the den so that the snakes within would be sealed there forever, and the snakes without would have no place to find refuge. On the day the men chose to return, nearly 50 desert diamondbacks were gathered at the portals of the cave. The men shot them, clubbed them, smashed them with rocks. Some of the rattlers escaped the attack and crawled into the den. Crotalus had not yet arrived for the autumn rendezvous. He came that night. The den's mouth was a shattered mass of rock, for the men had done their dynamiting well. Dead members of his tribe lay everywhere. Crotalus nosed among them, tongue flicking as he slid slowly along. There was no access to the cave anymore. He spent the night outside among the dead. The morning sun warmed him and awakened him. He lay there at full length. He had no place to go. The sun grew hotter upon him, and instinctively he began to slide towards some protective shade. Then his senses warned him of some animal presence nearby. He stopped, half coiled, raised his head, and began to rattle. He saw two upright figures. He did not know what they were, because he had never seen men before. "That's the granddaddy of them all," said one of the homesteaders. "It's a good thing we came back." He raised his shotgun.
But thank you for your solicitousness.
Thank you for your service.
Here's a backup in case anything happens to that one.
Backup.
I'll take that one. Has that one.
Backup.
Yes. This one is yours?
Yes.
Now both of them are. Well, okay.
That's what the show is now.
Well, I already had one anyway.
Exactly. Now you can have another one.
That's why I don't
need
to
say this.
I'm going to go stand over here.
I'm famous. just for about stealing lighters.
Take a stand for it.
Yeah, that's different. That's a felony.
Oh, that's
a felony.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's not just that you steal lighters.
Did you plan
it's that you
it?
Take your fingers and like pull off the stuff I put on the outside.
If I stole your lighter, they wouldn't smoke as many cigarettes, which that was weird.
Smoke that cigarette.
Like a social intervention?
Yeah, it was. I'm really thinking of the other person.
You're like,
it's not that I want the lighter.
So
they've got nothing to the beautiful cartoonists at Dermophilia. They take your lighter and, you just don't want to demand it back. You're happy that they have it.
You can always buy another lighter.
Shut off his back.
Yeah.
That's me.
That's what virtually everybody says in every murder or crime
they
story.
They say he wouldn't hurt a fly.
He wouldn't hurt a fly.
He was so funny and smart and,
I know what you're doing right now is fake broadcasting, right? I mean, I hear voices. It's because it's real. It's true.
You often hear voices in such a fashion?
We are going to ask you to listen to this song and tell me your honest opinion.
Let them eat cake.
I'm
going to drink them small, please.
Damn, this is good. Who is it? Whoever you say it, I like it.
I want a girl.
You're listening to the Ask Dr. Hal Show live on radio on Radio Valencia here in San Francisco on 22nd Street near Mission. We hope you're enjoying our program. Please stay tuned for more of the same.
It was a nice offer. And then last year, as I was packing for Burning Man, she came by. But usually, I go by her house and I don't even see it. And isn't that the same old story? You know, it will be my theme in glory to tell the old, old story. Even though in glory, everybody's heard that story. But you can't object to the story when you're living up there in glory. So you have to hear that story today and tomorrow and forever and forever. And you'll listen if you're clever. Somebody kick the bucket. Yes, we were there before. Somebody kicked the bucket. Does you mean the bucket?
Right, it's a little too rich. Sometimes if you pee, you know, after supper, you'll get like a really red pee.
Trying to clean yourself out, but without adequate fluids in your hydraulically operated body.
That's what's
Yes, humans are a bunch of squishy liquids contained inside enveloping skin in the endless reaches of the universe. There once existed a planet that glowed like a star in the distant heavens. Krypton. Yes, meaning by a rather hidden world. Mental and physical Superman. Yeah, they were Superman even then. And when they got to our neck of the woods, they were even more
That to me
powerful.
Always amuses me.
See, I can't like this because one of those cartoonist girls took my lighter and didn't give it back.
Well, I have a new lighter, and so they'll probably take that one too, and they'll be welcome to it.
A dead soldier in between my fingers.
The show can't be responsible for any dreams that have been crushed.
Ma'am, I need for you to help me out, ma'am.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to moon crash.
Hello, cat. Hello, workers.
Moon crash? Oh, let's hope that doesn't happen. You know, that giant asteroid that they say has only a 3% chance of hitting us has a larger percentage of hitting the moon. And that could be bad for us, too. We need the moon to be right where it is.
Hey, Mr. Moon, don't mess around. Like K-Rock, he's messing
around. I heard about that.
Yeah. Terrible.
Well, that maybe Michael Pepe can do something about.
Bob's just looking for someone to love.
Just want someone to love.
That lady on the radio is so sad.
Now it's the Alchemist playing some of this great music. The kids these days go for this kind of stuff. What is that, 40-year-old kids? Look at Susie Wrong.
I'll just wait over here.
The telescope makes us see how small and petty our problems are.
Come on, we're not staying on the moon.
All we need to do is look into the bright light.
No, because Whitey's there and it's ruined everything. They're in the nose here, Lincoln administration.
Whitey went to the moon.
The red velvet is good.
I was speaking of the giant tortoise that predicted the birth of the moon.
Slow down.
Okay,
it should rain for Raiders. Holy Raiders.
Breaking a trillion newton meters.
When I hit more, a fault of my death.
Are there any casualties? Is my brother okay?
Yes,
the number's still unconfirmed.
It's really not a tortoise, but a turtle.
It's in bad shape.
It's out of water.
As we enter Earth, it's
but the ancient Buddhists may not have been scientifically
accelerating.
Just calm down, babies. Have a piece of cake.
It's a lot of cake.
And it streaks for Earth. You're saying that I caused the meteor to...
Wait.
Some of the faster
plane is all about Star Wars. And Star
I'm saying just that.
No.
You caused the meteor.
I get down.
Damn it. You gotta get down.
Let's get down.
Everybody do the meteor.
Everybody
do the meteor.
Somebody close that air leak. We're in space. The air doesn't grow in trees. We're waiting for Michael Pepe to come.
Our system should be able to handle Michael
Pepe. Please. Haven't seen him since the Saint is Soup Stupid. He's not going to get muh. He's going to get chuh. Anyway, he's not here yet, but we saw him at St. Stupid's Day, and he was in fine fettle, marching along in St. Stupid's band of brothers. Who was? And
yep, I hear EBN, get down.
Well,
but he's making the little bobheads be all on people.
They're just appearing, emanating, popping out.
Elon Musk was at the parade, St. Stupid's parade.
And a horrible little dwarfish Donald Trump about 2.5 feet high.
That was really impressive.
Leon.
And then there was the street sweeper that cleaned up after the parade. The mustache, the push broom, the white uniform, and the white cap. Just like at the end of Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Get down.
Look at Pepe, he's really getting down.
Do you want to get down?
Huh?
What's it going?
Look at Pepe go, you know. All we need to do is harness this power and there'd be no energy crisis.
Come on, get your back up.
And there's a movie of Clinton, the spaceman himself, with Eddie Murphy playing George Clinton. The death
of a Western gladiator is a story by Charles Finney, who lived in Arizona when I did, who worked at the Arizona Daily Star newspaper, often as a linotype operator, and typesetter. He had written amazing books which few people knew about. Among these was The Circus of Dr. Low, made into a movie as The Seven Faces of Dr. Low.
The dancing little thing.
While he pontificates and orates, waving his parade leader's baton. And directly behind him, the huge, grimacing
Doctor. What your thing is. What you did to it. You rotoscoped it.
What? Oh, the effect on the phone?
The effect on Man in the Moon Marigold?
Yeah, when the Whitey landed on the moon.
Whitey's on the moon. I just get my welfare check, and Whitey's on the moon.
Yeah, I just heard that on NPR because they were talking about Whitey being on the moon because of the Mars. I think Trump said we're going to Mars.
Well, Trump knows nothing, and even Elon ought to know that we can't go to Mars just without living on the moon for a while. Or else your expedition to Mars is definitely going to fail and people will be dead before they get there.
Man, that'd be a bummer.
Nobody has ever managed to live away from the Earth for a significant length of time. There's stuff on the Earth that keeps you alive, and it's not fully understood. But every time they tried to create a fully enclosed biosphere, it fails, and it turns into blobs of stinking glup and mold and so forth, because we don't know all the factors that keep it balanced. And we might kill them off in our own biosphere through ignorance. But what you got to do is go to the moon. It's easy to reach. And then build your habitat there and figure out how to keep it going. Then you can go to Mars. And you can do all that mining, that deep space mining. Space is full of stuff. It costs huge fortunes to bring even the small amount of stuff up out of Earth's gravity, but it's easy to bring things down through Earth's gravity. There are huge rocks of gold and platinum and nickel in the primordial state in the asteroid belt. They'd be easy to get. And there's water, plenty of water, which is needed on Earth and will be needed in the moon. All of water on Earth comes from space.
No, not yet. You'll say that, yeah.
It bombards Earth as it bombarded the moon. Tintin found ice on the moon, and he was right.
It's pretty far.
Oh, boy.
But we can send aerogel through them and pick up little tiny pieces.
The asteroids are all in a gravitational relationship with each other, and you move one of them and the others might move. If you bump one of them, you could start a chain of bumping and dislodging the paths and so forth. But they themselves are the fragments of a planet that used to exist, which was torn to shreds by Jupiter's enormous gravity well. And Jupiter's got control. If it wasn't for Jupiter, we'd be a lot worse off, too, because a lot of dangerous space junk that comes into the solar system gets captured by Jupiter, the most powerful gravity out there, and it doesn't come our way.
All right, I gotta go make pasta or something.
Yeah, just like the James Bond theme came from a song about a nose.
Ah, the nose, the nose. Jumping Jupiter.
When he got hired to do the James Bond thing, he just reworked the nose song into that. All right. Stop. Mega black theme. That's good, right?
That's a familiar special effect. He's Bob don't ever change. He's Bob, always Woody Bob. Pipe is the one with the noddle that rains on the roof like fire. It's the one with the waddle and flame in your desire. Bob don't ever change. He's Bob, always Woody Bob. The Electro Asylum Sound Effects Records. Scream of anguish scream. No, it is the scream of ecstasy, Sahib. So, you
see when they hear this program. They say, zim, zim, salabim.
They do?
Arch.
Well, they might say anything.
You're going way too fast. You must turn it down.
It's Godzilla, Mr.
Arch. Godzilla is going way too fast. Oh, you must turn him slow.
He walks slowly, but he covers a lot of ground.
I know. It's painless.
Make him go slow, or I will insist that you take Godzilla off the air.
Now they're doing yoga on VJ's channel.
It's the birth of all the little boblets.
We'll see boblets.
Stop, all boblets.
Boblets born. Degenerated.
Boblets do think they help themselves. They're just doing it.
Thousands of jellied eggs in the sea. Limited.
And there'll be
something to be.